Hey everybody, welcome to episode 12. This is episode 12, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the 13 o'clock podcast. We had the computer shit the bed over the weekend, so we have kind of a new setup. Hopefully it sounds better and not worse, but we'll see how it goes. Also, if you hadn't noticed, our audio-only version of the podcast is now on a revamped new network called the Project Entertainment Network. So all of our new episodes, just the audio version, will be there instead of Project iRadio. They're doing a transition.
Yeah, it's a cooler network anyway, so this is a move up.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah, it's all good. So with that housekeeping out of the way, we should get right into the topic, which today is probably one of the best known haunting slash poltergeist cases in the world.
And it's actually the benchmark case. This case is the case of all cases. It's the absolute best example of what poltergeist phenomena is like. I read the book about this case. It's called The Enfield Haunting. I read the book about it, and it just is perfect. It's a perfect case. It perfectly describes what living through a poltergeist episode is like.
Yeah. And if you're actually not familiar with this case, which I'd be surprised if you weren't, but if you saw the movie The Conjuring 2, that was loosely based on that.
Very loosely.
Very loosely. And also there was a TV series, like a three-part miniseries produced for British TV called The Enfield Haunting. A
little bit better, but...
Which was better, but... Well, the first two episodes stuck pretty close to the story, and then the third one just went flying right off the rails and had people flying around and ghosts and shit.
And they added a bunch of drama and conflict that wasn't there.
That wasn't there.
If you really want to know what the Enfield Poltergeist was about, you have to get Guy Lyon Playfair's book, This House is Haunted. And they just re-released it. They just republished that.
Yeah, I think they because for a while it was out of print.
Right. I have one of the old out of print ones. Jenny bought it for me. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was like an old library book.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't available. But
I had originally read the book back in the 80s when I was in high school. I think it was in 87.
Yeah.
And it just blew my mind. It was like, yeah, that's it. That's kind of what I went through.
Yeah.
It's just that her poltergeist episode was a lot worse than mine. She was fantastic at it.
Yeah. Well, it went on a lot longer.
A long time, and it was, it had a bunch of weird phenomena that wasn't found in other cases.
Yeah.
Which we can get into that in a bit.
Yeah.
But, huge plug for this book. Guy Lyon Playfair is the author. He was there with Morris Gross when they investigated the case. Went on for a long time. You had cops and newspaper people there. Reporters saw it. And the name of the book is This House is Haunted.
And actually, the way that book was written was kind of the inspiration for how we first wrote the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. I liked the matter-of-fact kind of setup of the book where it wasn't really... Because the book is not really exaggerated.
No, and it's not hyped up. And it's just a straight account of what was observed and what people saw and what people said they saw.
Yeah.
And he differentiates between the two.
Yeah.
This person's... In other words, they didn't take everything for granted. This person said they saw this, but we don't know. I didn't know. Or I don't know because I didn't see it. That
right.
type of deal.
Yeah.
And that's the best way to report something like
that. And the guy that wrote the book was actually in and out of the house over probably like a 18-month period.
Yeah, Guy.
Guy Playfair.
Guy Playfair.
He was in the house for a long time with the family. So he saw a lot of things personally. But he was, you know, quick to report when it wasn't something that he saw personally.
And he was also quick to say when he didn't believe something.
Yeah. Because there are some kind of aspects to this case that... Because a lot of super skeptical people, which I am too, but a lot of super skeptical people just think none of it was legitimate just because of a few little details.
They go with the approach, well, this person lied, so therefore the whole case isn't true.
Right.
No, I mean, you know, a good case has
not necessarily.
A good case can have a bunch of different people involved, and some of these people lie.
Yeah.
You know?
It happens.
I even think the Warrens showed up on this case for like a day.
Yeah. And according to some of the people that were on the case for a long time, like, you know, I believe it was Graham Morris, who was a photographer for the Daily Mirror at the time, and he was one of the first people to go investigate it. He claimed that the Warrens only showed up for one day and that they showed up uninvited.
Right.
Like they were not asked to come there.
But sounds like the Warrens.
Yeah, that does sound like them.
And that same photographer, what was his name again?
Graham Morris.
Graham Morris got hit in the head with a Lego brick, and that's what made him a believer. He saw Lego bricks jumping around on the floor and flying out of unseen directions where there was nobody's in that corner.
Yeah.
And, you know, tried And he tried to catch pictures of it, but it was so quick and so elusive that no matter where the camera was pointed, the Lego brick would come from another direction.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Which is, that's the same kind of phenomenon I saw.
Yeah. It's kind of like it always happens out of the corner of your eye or behind you, or
it's like it can't move something if you're looking directly at it.
And we discussed
that. Which is weird though, because there were some cases where we did see things move when we were looking right at it. It was just weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
We discussed a little bit of that on our Mammoth Mountain show.
Yeah.
But so I'll put a link to that in here.
You definitely want to get this book. This House is Haunted by Guy Lyon Playfair.
It is very good.
If you like that one, get ours. Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. Very similar. And also Rochdale Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah. See, yeah, similar kind of poltergeist cases. Uh-huh. So, okay. So the Enfield Poltergeist case began in 1977. Enfield is in North London.
Mm-hmm.
And the house, it was the Hodgson family. They lived in a little council house. Now, Peggy Hodgson was the mother, and she was living in the house with her four children, who were Margaret, who was 13, Janet, who was 11, and probably the main poltergeist focus, Johnny, who was 10, and Billy, who was 7. Now, Peggy had just undergone a divorce, which in 1977 was still pretty unusual.
Yeah.
So she was actually a single mother.
And this is a very poor family.
And they were very poor, yeah. And apparently there was a lot of contention between the ex-husband, who now had a new girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I read that he would sometimes like come by to see the kids, and he would bring the new girlfriend with him. Yeah. So there was like a lot of tension in the household, which might have been what triggered off the whole episode.
And 70s was also kind of like a dark economic times for England, too.
True,
It was economically oppressed.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of poverty, a lot of unhappiness in the UK in the 70s.
Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of what. And additionally, you know, the two girls were around puberty age.
Yeah. They were sisters.
Yeah, sisters. So, which is a very common kind of thing that you see in poltergeist cases.
They had an older brother, too, but he wasn't in the house.
No, younger.
Younger?
Did they?
I think they had an older brother that wasn't in the house and a younger one that was in the house.
There's two younger ones in the house.
Okay. Maybe I have a case mixed. Scratch that then.
Never mind.
I thought they had an older one that had left the house.
I don't think they had gotten in trouble. Oh, maybe.
Okay, never mind.
It's not relevant anymore.
I haven't read the book in a long time.
So basically, the disturbances started in late summer of 1977, in August. And the first thing that happened, as is the case with most of these kind of things, it started very small.
Yeah.
The first thing that happened was, you know, the kids had gone upstairs to bed or whatever, and they started to complain that they were hearing shuffling noises and that their beds were wobbling, quote unquote wobbling.
Whatever. I think I know what that means. They kind of moving side to side. Yeah. And
now, they complained to their mother about this, and their mother was just like, you know, I'm tired. Knock that shit off. Yeah. All right, you damn kids. Go to sleep.
Right.
So she didn't think anything of it at first. But then, the next evening, Peggy, the mother, she hears all this banging coming from upstairs, and the kids are kind of freaking out. So she goes up there to kind of tell them to pipe down. Mm-hmm. And she sees, according to her, a chest of drawers.
Yeah, a big one.
Slide across the floor by itself.
Yeah. And she grabbed it and tried to push it back.
To push it back where it was.
Yeah, and she got into a fight with this thing for a few seconds.
Yeah, and it wouldn't go.
Yeah, it scared her.
She said it seemed like it was trying to push itself against the door, like it was trying to trap them in the room.
Right, okay.
Or something. She said that's what it seemed like.
Yeah.
So, obviously that frightened them quite a bit.
Yeah, and the kids panicked.
Yeah.
Because I think that was the first thing they actually saw move.
Yeah, because before I think it was just the beds shaking.
Yeah, beds shaking and sounds.
Yeah, and they also heard knocking on the walls. Like, it would go up and down the walls like someone was on the other side of the wall, like, running up and down, knocking on it.
Yeah, and it would appear from random places. It might appear from a ceiling.
Or from the ceiling.
Or
also.
A floor. It was, you know, it was all over the place.
Right. Now,
sporadic, though.
Yeah. So this was starting to freak them out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now, Peggy went over to their neighbor's house.
Yeah, it didn't freak them out a little bit. It put them in a panic.
Yeah, pretty much.
Let's just call it for what it is.
I was using understatement.
Yeah, you were understating. She panicked and she ran from the house and tried to get help from the neighbors.
Yeah, the neighbors were the Nottinghams.
Yeah.
And Vic Nottingham, big burly dude. You can see him on, there are documentaries about this, and you can see him on there talking about what he witnessed. And he kind of came over there. Yeah. He was a big old construction worker.
Yeah.
And he heard the knocking on the walls and the ceiling.
And heard that it was moving around.
Yeah.
You could direct it to go to a certain place, and it would knock from that place.
Yeah. And he was a little...
He was freaked.
He was a little freaked.
He was freaked. They interviewed him. He said that it scared the hell out of him. He told him to call the cops.
Yeah.
No.
So Peggy did call the cops.
Yeah.
Which, you know, she didn't know what else to do, really, I guess.
Right.
So she called the police. They sent two officers out. And while the officers were there, one of them, her name is Carolyn Heaps, she said that she saw a chair in the living room levitate off the floor and move 4 feet by itself.
Yeah. Was it 4 feet? I didn't realize it was that far.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. But what's interesting about this is the first time a cop has gone on record. She wrote that down in her report.
Yes, she filed an affidavit that said as much.
Right.
And she said after she saw that happen, she checked the chair to make sure there were no wires or anybody was pulling it, and she couldn't find anything.
You can find interviews with her. She was upset by what she saw. She was like, that's what I saw.
And she also went on camera
saying
that's what she saw. She said she saw the chair move by herself. Yeah. She checked for trickery and couldn't find anything.
Brave woman to write that down.
Yeah, probably. Especially in 1977, because that was still kind of a...
People
would probably think you were nuts if you said that.
Yeah, now over time, if I remember correctly from the book, more police would show up every now and then and actually watch little things happen. And it became quite a story around the police house, that, you know, the police station. They knew about it.
They knew about it, yeah.
But there was nothing they could do. No law was being broken.
Right, and that's what the cops said. Basically, they were like, you know, we're sorry this is happening to you, but, you know, no one's breaking any laws. And it's like, it's not a police matter. Stuff's moving around by itself. We don't know what to do about that. So they couldn't do anything.
Right.
So the next Peggy decided to call the press.
Yeah, for help.
For help.
Yeah.
So the first ones to come were from the Daily Mirror. There was a reporter and a photographer. The photographer's name was Graham Morris. I don't remember what the reporter's name was.
Yeah, he's a cool guy, and you can see a lot of interviews with him.
Yeah, he's also in the documentary.
And he's very sincere sounding about how spooky it was.
Yeah, they did say that the house was, I mean, when he came, he said the house was chaos.
Yeah.
He said there was just little things flying around, marbles, little toys, stuff. And he's like, everyone was freaking out and screaming.
Yeah, you have to imagine that the kids are in a panic. They're afraid. They think it's ghosts. And the mother was evidently kind of like paralyzed and in fear and kind of in a state of confusion. I mean, what do you do? You can't stop it.
I guess you would if that started happening in your house all of a sudden. Yeah.
Well, you're seeing something that people have told you your whole life isn't true.
Yeah.
You know, it is true.
Yeah. Because shit's flying around everywhere.
Yeah.
But Graham Morris, the photographer from the Daily Mirror, said that, like you mentioned before, that he got hit in the head quite hard with a Lego brick.
Yeah, while he was trying to take a photograph.
It just hit him in the head, and
left a dimple there, Mark.
Yeah.
For several days.
Yeah.
It hit him with some force.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one had been in the area where the direction.
Yeah.
I don't believe anyone had been in the direction that it had been thrown from.
In the book, he said that they could see, like, in one part of the corner of the room, 4 or 5 Lego bricks jumping up and down, and then some of them went flying, and then it would just stop immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't a constant movement of things. It was like sporadic. Things would move for a few seconds, then stop.
Yeah.
A few minutes later, they would move again.
Yeah.
And then it would kind of ebb and flow, like a typical poltergeist case, where you might have a lot of activity in a 2-hour period, and then it trails off for 3 or 4 hours, 5 hours, and then it comes back for a few hours. It's like that.
Yeah. Now, also, there are reports that the BBC sent out a film crew as well. And from some of the reports I've read, like I said, it's kind of hard to say because, you know, the book was a guy that was there. But, you know, like a lot of stuff, it's either believers or it's like total skeptics that think the whole thing was a fraud.
Right.
But reportedly, the BBC sent a film crew out and they managed to capture some things on camera. But then after they left, they found that the insides of their cameras, like little pieces of it, were bent and that all of the tape had been erased.
Yeah, typical.
Yeah. Almost like it didn't want to be.
Yeah, poltergeist won't let you record that. whatever it is.
They're very shy like that. So I don't know if that's true, but some reports do say that, that all of their footage was erased. And then...
Or destroyed.
Or destroyed.
Yeah.
So after all this, finally someone thought to contact, I believe it's one of the media people, someone thought to contact the Society for Psychical Research to
right.
come investigate. And they sent out Maurice Gross, who was, you know, one of their investigators. He's also an electrical engineer.
He was an inventor, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And they sent Guy Lyon Playfair, who was an author, and he had written a lot of books on poltergeist phenomena.
Was it poltergeist phenomena? I thought it might have been the...
Yeah, I think that's why they sent him out, because
okay.
he was... They called him, like, a poltergeist expert. Like,
okay,
he had written some other books about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he also read... he had written some books about that psychic surgery.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which he said a lot of that's fake, but he
yeah.
saw a few cases of it when he was in Brazil that he couldn't explain.
Right.
That he could
okay.
actually see a hole into a person's body and somebody reach into there
yeah.
and close it back up. That's weird. I don't know what to think of that.
Ew.
I don't know what to think of that.
So,
I think most of that's magic tricks, but who knows? Maybe
yeah,
we'll do
it's
a
just,
show
you
on
just
that.
Palm like chicken guts yeah. and stuff. I've seen them. I've
Playfair
seen
Playfair said he saw one where it looked like he could see into the body cavity for a second.
Yeah.
Weird. Unless it was some kind of an illusion.
Yeah, it might have been.
That a magician could do, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so Guy Lyon Playfair was the one who would eventually write the book about the case. It's called This House is Haunted, which we were trying to plug because it's really, really good. But he's not paying us or anything. We just
no.
really, we just really like that
no,
book.
No, that's an awesome book. You got to read it.
Okay, so when the SPR got there, Maurice Gross said he also saw marbles and Lego bricks flying around. And that when you picked them up, they were hot.
Mm-hmm.
Which, very common.
Yeah.
In poltergeist cases, that's reported a lot.
Yeah.
Although
it didn't happen in mine.
No, it
right.
didn't. But
okay.
it does in probably
in
80-85% of
yeah.
cases that are reported. Where objects fly around, they usually pick them up after and they're warm or they're hot. He also said that he was standing by a table and there was a t-shirt on the table and he saw the t-shirt fly off by itself, even
yeah.
though no one was standing around it but him.
Yeah.
So the two of them, Maurice Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, they pretty much, I don't think they lived with the family. They did sometimes. I think sometimes they stayed.
They did it in shifts.
Yeah, but they were there for pretty much the whole outbreak, weren't they?
Yeah, and it's 18 months, right?
It lasted about 18 months.
18 months, yeah.
So they were pretty much, I mean, at least one of them or someone else from the media or something like that were on site pretty much all the time.
Yeah, they were under observation.
Yeah.
Almost all the time.
So, and kind of here's where, because a lot of skeptics, and I'll get set away right now, a lot of skeptics are pretty much sure that Janet and Margaret were faking the whole thing.
Oh, man.
But
they could have faked that.
That's the thing, though. If they were under observation all the time.
I don't even think a trained magician could fake
some of the things. I mean, obviously, yeah, it'd be pretty easy to fake, you know, hey, look over there, and I'm going to throw a marble or whatever. But it's like, some of the shit was big. Like some
yeah.
of the, like Maurice Gross said in Guy Lyon Playfair's book, they said he saw furniture like flipping over.
Wait, pulled a water heater out of the wall.
It wasn't a water heater. It was a like an iron grate, like the old coal fireplaces they have
okay.
over there.
All right. Yeah. I saw a picture of it and it
yeah.
was all bent.
Was that in Janet and Margaret's bedroom?
Yeah. And they said the little girls weren't strong enough. Even both of them together couldn't have.
Yeah. It was made of iron. Like if you know, like if you anything know, I was in the UK in 95 and some of the older houses still had these, but it's like an iron grate, like for their
yeah.
little fireplace or their little
yeah,
hearth or
yanked,
whatever.
It yanked it out
of the wall.
Yanked it out of the wall. And you could see, he has photos of it in the book. You could see where it was mounted. It was like twisted and bent.
Right.
And those two little girls
and
together
yeah,
couldn't
I don't
have
see
them.
How two little girls could have done
yeah.
that. And I also don't see how they could flip a couch over while
no.
and no one noticed.
And
it.
A lot of the stuff that was moving and was witnessed moving was far away from the girls.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
30 feet or in other rooms.
Yeah.
So, no, there's no way.
Yeah.
You couldn't fake it. You couldn't fake that many people for that length of time.
Yeah.
Couldn't fool them.
That's what I mean. And there were people there all the time.
Yeah. They played little tricks. And Maurice Gross admitted that. Every now and then they'd get bored and they'd play a little trick and blame it on the ghost. But they
yeah.
got caught.
But they got caught. I mean, pretty much.
And then the little tricks that the girls would do were things that the poltergeist was not doing.
Yeah,
like
I think one time
right.
they stole his tape recorder
right.
and hid it somewhere.
Right.
And then he was like, and then they were like, we're going to blame that on the ghost.
Right.
But
yeah.
He caught them.
Yeah. And they're little girls. They're 13-year-old girls. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah. And they were getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Out of this. But so basically, I mean, Graham Norris, Guyland Playfair, they saw furniture flipping over. They saw toys flying around. They heard the knocking sounds up and down the walls and on the ceiling. I think Graham Morris even reported little fires starting spontaneously. There were also some reports that Janet had been seen levitating.
Yeah, somebody outside on the street saw
that. There were two neighbors. I think one was quote unquote a lollipop lady, which we would call a crossing guard. And she was outside and she said that she saw Janet floating in the window, like laying on her back, but floating like up in the window.
Yeah.
And
she saw it from the street now.
She saw it from the street.
Yeah.
And another neighbor said they saw that too.
Right.
That was walking by. So, you know, I don't know how real that is. Now, if you know anything about the Enfield case, you will have seen probably the very famous series of photographs.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of levitation, that claim to show Janet being hurled out of her bed.
Right.
These were taken, just for some background. Graham Morris set up a camera in the girl's bedroom to take a picture every few seconds, like every second or every half second or whatever it was. And, so he got this series of photographs that look like Janet's, like, you know, quote unquote, flying off her bed.
Yeah. That's not what I think's happening. But.
Yeah. Now, if you see all the photographs in tandem, because usually they only show the one of her, like, in the middle of the air, like, freaking out or screaming or whatever. If you see all the photographs in tandem, like, in the entire series, then it's pretty clear that she's just jumping off the bed. Like, it was a trampoline.
Yeah. There's an explanation for that, though.
Yeah.
I think she's kind of going in, she's in a, in kind of a fugue state.
Yeah.
And her right hemisphere of her brain's firing off. Pretty, you know, and her, what do you call it? She's subconsciously jumping out of bed and she's thinking somebody else is causing her to do it. Almost kind of like what you'd see from a kid who's been, undergoing what you'd call it, like a case of possession.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of involuntary movements.
Right.
That's what I think it is. And she thinks she's being thrown out, but she's actually jumping out.
Yeah.
Now, out of one of those photos, there's something very interesting in it that people don't point out. You can see her, and in one of the photos, I believe she's in bed or either jumping up. I don't remember exactly what it was, but you could see that the curtain looks like it's reaching over and grabbing the sheets.
Yeah.
And moving the sheets out of the way.
Yeah.
Which is a weird. See how she could have faked that.
Because she wasn't touching it.
She wasn't touching it. No, but you can see the sheet wrapping around the blanket and moving the blanket aside.
Yeah.
Seems to be.
And then there's also, speaking of the levitation, there's also a photo of her laying in this really strange position, like on top of a dresser or something like that. And I think the investigators claim that she kind of landed there.
Right.
In this kind of strange position, like draped over this dresser.
I think she ended up there, but I don't think she landed on there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I remember correctly, she's on top of a record player.
Yeah, that's right. It's a record, like a cabinet style record player.
And doesn't the record player have a clear plastic lid on it?
It looks like it does. It's hard to tell from the photo.
Those weren't very strong.
No.
If she fell on that, she probably
would have broken it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because I used to have one of those back in the 70s.
I think she's just kind of in a trance, climbing around inside the room.
Yeah.
In a state of semi-consciousness. That's just what I think. But I don't know.
Yeah.
With today's technology, we would know, because you could set up a good camera in there. But in those days, they didn't really have video cameras that were affordable.
Yeah, that's true.
They just had it was just a camera that was on a trigger. When they heard a noise, they'd press a button and it would take a photograph.
Yeah. Or like I said, you could set it up to take a photo every
few seconds.
Every few seconds or every half second or whatever I said. Okay, so speaking of trance, I wanted to go a little bit into one of the most interesting aspects of this case was that Janet's, I don't want to say possession because it wasn't like a demon, but it was almost like something was talking through her.
Yeah. Pretty weird.
You know what I mean?
We have recordings of it.
Yeah. So actually what I'm going to do right now, since we're at about the 25 minute mark, I'm going to take a break.
Okay.
And then when we come back,
We'll come back to the voice.
Yeah, I'll play some of the tape recordings that Maurice Gross did of her talking in this weird voice, and we'll kind of discuss that a little bit. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a couple minutes.
If you're into cosplay, corsetry, steampunk, gothic, or rockabilly clothing, shoes, and accessories, then you must visit Subculture Corsets and Clothing, either online at www.subculturecorsets.com or drop by their store at the Avenues Mall in Jacksonville, Florida, located a half mile off I-95. Tell them you heard their ad on Project Entertainment Network and the 13 O'Clock Podcast and receive a 10% discount off your entire purchase. Or when checking out on their website, use the discount code 13 O'Clock and receive a 10% discount on your entire order. And if you're a full-figured girl, don't worry. Subculture carries sizes 4 through 4X, and they have men's clothing as well. That's subculturecorsets.com, and use discount code 13O'Clock for a 10% discount. Go check out their website now, subculturecorsets.com, or when traveling through Jacksonville, Florida, stop in and check out their store at the Avenues Mall.
I'm Captain Battlesley, and I'm one of them characters in the Kirkland Journals, Project Entertainment Network's Pro Wrestling Podcast. Every Friday, Tokyo Tom, Lord Steve Mesa, and the Viking, Superkick Pro Wrestling in the Hot Spot. Featuring interviews with the up-and-coming indie superstars. They're a stable that shoots while it works. You can only hear them on the Project Entertainment Network. Thank you very much. Remember the Alamo!
The Necrocasticon. The podcast that blends horror and heavy metal properties with a common connection. Brought to you by hosts Token Tom Glock, Max X, Smoking Walt Hades, and Azrael Mordecai. Featuring interviews and more with the stars of metal and horror. The Necrocasticon, Mondays on Project Entertainment Network.
Okay.
We're back.
We're back.
The voice.
The voice.
Okay.
Now, the weirdest thing about this voice, according to Maurice Gross and according to some other people that were there, he was recording, he was trying to, you know, he had recorded like some of the knocking sounds. Mm-hmm. He recorded like the family's reactions when something would move. So sometimes you'd have recordings of like something banging and everybody going, what was that? Or, you know what I mean? He had also recorded these kind of weird, like I said, weird knocking sounds. Also the sound of a dog barking.
Yeah.
When
they have a recording of that, too.
They do have a recording of that. And they didn't have a dog. The Hodgsons didn't have a dog. Their neighbors did not have a dog. So he recorded a dog barking. Now, at some point, Maurice said that he made an observation. He's like, now, if only this thing would talk.
Yeah. Made
and
a comment.
Shortly afterward,
it started to talk.
A voice started coming out of Janet.
Yeah.
That was not her voice.
Right. And when you read the book, you know, he tells the whole story of how it built up to this. It's awesome. You just got to read the book.
Yeah.
It's really creepy.
But what ended up happening, and like I said, this is a very controversial aspect of the case. But I think what I'm going to do now, I think I have three little clips of her voice.
Yeah, but you know what? You have to set up what the voice is talking about.
Okay.
The voice is talking. It's the voice of Bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now here's the creepy thing about this.
Yeah.
Now when they have a little bit of video of her like talking in that voice, and it's almost like her mouth is moving, but kind of not.
Yeah. She had an overbite, so it's hard to see.
Yeah, she had a real big overbite, like she had real big.
The way the voice sounds is pretty trippy, and what the voice says in this one recording is quite.
Yeah. Strange. Like at first, she kind of said, like kind of childish things or nonsensical things, or she would swear at the investigators, like
swearing and
fucking
barking.
Old sod, stuff like that, barking like a dog, things like that,
making funny comments,
making like little smartass comments, and this voice was like very like, I'm gonna play some of it later, but this voice, it was very gruff and very gravelly. It sounded like an old man's voice, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And
kind of, no, it sounds like an old man's voice.
It does sound like an old man's voice. And it would be, I mean, would it be impossible to fake? No, but I don't know how she could talk like that for such a long time.
Well, they did tape her mouth shut, and they put water in her mouth and taped it shut, and that voice came out of her throat still.
And the voice came out, yeah.
Yeah,
the voice came out still.
They brought in a specialist that was a specialist in speech, and he couldn't figure out how she did it.
Yeah, true.
That's pretty weird.
Because, I mean, skeptics are saying, oh, she's like a ventriloquist, or she was using that upper fold, you know, your false vocal cords, quote unquote. But here's the creepiest thing. She said, this voice said, he said his name was Bill.
Mm-hmm.
He said he had come from the graveyard down the road, right?
Yeah. And then he fell asleep and died downstairs in a chair after he went blind.
He went blind first. And then he said, and then Janet, in the guise of Bill, said, I died in a chair in the living room of the house.
Downstairs.
Yeah. I had a hemorrhage.
Yeah. And went blind. And then he went blind. Something like that.
Yeah.
But it's creepy. It turned out that there was a guy named Bill that died.
Yeah. From and a here's the weirdest
and
thing.
Went blind downstairs.
They did some research. The researchers went and dug around who had lived in this house before.
Yeah.
A man named Bill Wilkins. Bill Wilkins was dead, obviously, but his son was still alive. And his son said, yeah, my dad went blind, and then he died of a brain hemorrhage in a chair in that corner of the room, just like she said.
And that voice sounded like him.
And that sounded like him talking.
Wow, let's hear it.
Okay, so we're going to play a couple ones now, and then we'll come back and talk about it some more.
Did any friends go with you?
Yes, told them. Older dogs, 68 dogs.
And what do you got 68 dogs for?
So that they can protect me from you killing me. They can bite you, Adol.
How can we kill you, Bill?
You could shoot me off.
Now how can we shoot you if we can't see you, Bill?
Bunt
man
to God.
Sorry, I didn't hear that, Bill.
Bunt man to God.
By praying to God. So, what you're saying is we could get rid of you by praying to God.
Yes.
Why can't Janet fill you?
I'm invisible.
You're invisible? Why are you invisible?
I'm a G-H-O-S-T. Right, that's good. I am. Shut up your door. I'm 32 years old. I come from Jewish graveyard. And I have right near the church where we live. All my friends come from there as well, and we all make a game and go to the pub, and then we pick your house, because I used to live here, and I will tell you some more, and if you don't get anyone else, the second one and Mr. Blaine.
I want you to tell me whether you remember what happened to you when you died. Just before you died and just after you died.
Days before I died, my day. I went blind. Then I had an hemorrhage and I fell asleep and I died in a chair in the corner downstairs.
Okay.
Bizarre.
Yeah, pretty weird.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's a lot of, I mean, if you look around, there's a lot of recordings of her talking like that.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't see how she could talk like that for such a long time without messing her throat out.
But the message, was it from the dead? I don't think it was.
Yeah.
I think she made that voice. Well, I know she made the voice because they have her on camera doing that voice. I think either one or two things. Either somehow she psychically channeled the past or gained access to what happened in the past subconsciously. And she made a fake manifestation of Bill. Or she had heard about Bill. And the parents didn't know that she knew about Bill.
And she was subconsciously.
Or consciously.
Yeah.
I don't know. That some people saw the RSPK, the moving objects, and they believed that because they saw that. And then those same people that saw that didn't really believe that voice.
Yeah.
They thought that she was using that voice to get more attention. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a poltergeist event going on because right. they saw the PK, the psychokinesis. They yeah. saw that. So I don't know what to make of the voice.
Now, it should be said that Janet mm-hmm. said that she said it felt like the voice was coming from behind her.
Yeah.
Like there was something behind her, like yeah. talking, using her to talk.
It may have
because
been,
her mouth did move.
May have been her subconscious or her the right hemisphere of her brain.
Yeah.
May have been making that voice, may have been in control of that voice.
Yeah.
Without her conscious willing, her conscious, what's a good way to put it? Without her consciously wanting it, maybe it just came on its own.
Right.
You know?
Well, like you said, and I think you mentioned this on the Mammoth Mountain show that it's kind yeah. of like a spiritual Tourette syndrome.
Yeah, like a Tourette syndrome, right.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But, so we're not sure, like, how she knew about the guy, but apparently yeah. there was a real guy.
You're right.
And she said things like, I'm invisible, or
yeah.
she's, I'm a G-H-O-S-T. She's
yeah,
like
yeah,
one
yeah,
point
yeah.
in his voice. It's pretty freaky. Even if you think she's like faking, it's pretty freaky. Right. But that was a real guy, and she picked up on that somehow. Not sure how.
Nobody's sure.
And, okay, so like I said, this phenomenon went on for a very long time. People were in and out. There was a huge amount of media attention. I should point out that other than the girls, Janet and Margaret were the focus. Janet was mostly the focus, but her older sister was kind of a focus too. Because I think Margaret also talked in Bill's voice sometimes.
Yeah, they would report weird things like Guy, Mr. Playfair, he would be watching over them while they were asleep.
Yeah.
And Janet would say something strange in her sleep, and then the sister would respond in a weird voice. And then sometimes both of them would say the exact same thing at the same time while they were asleep. Almost yeah. kind of like there was some kind of link in between them.
Yeah.
But nobody knows.
That's pretty
nobody
weird.
Nobody knows, yeah.
So I already mentioned the one time where Janet and Margaret had moved Maurice's tape recorder and said they were going to blame it on the ghost. Yeah. Now, Janet and Margaret were also caught one time bending spoons. Physically yeah. bending spoons.
Okay, but another time she bent a spoon just by looking at it. Remember that? That's in the book.
Oh, is it? Okay.
That's in the book.
But one time they were caught bending themselves.
Bending them physically? Okay.
Bending them themselves. And some skeptics have said, well, because they were caught, I think maybe two or three times faking things, then that means that everything was faked?
No, couldn't.
But I don't know if it could have been. I mean, there were so many witnesses.
Some of the phenomena was so dramatic and there were so many witnesses. Those little girls couldn't have done that.
And Janet has said she does not give that many interviews because apparently this was not a happy time in her life.
Yeah. Friendly woman, but boy, she is eerie.
She is a little weird.
She's very eerie.
There are a few yeah. interviews with her. I think one of them she was shadowed, like in the dark. Yeah. But there are a couple of her where you can see her face. Yeah. And she is a very weird woman. She's in her she's 46, 47 now.
So she's got to be older than that because she's older than me.
Really?
Yeah. She's older than me.
Well, she was 11 in 1977.
Yeah, okay. Maybe then.
Yeah.
Similar.
I think, similar. I mean, because...
Okay.
They interviewed her. She's been interviewed recently because people were asking her how she felt about The Conjuring 2 coming out being based on her story. Mm-hmm. And she was evidently not happy about it.
No, well, it's not true.
Because she said, yeah, well, that too. But she said also she didn't really have a happy life at the time or subsequently. Mm-hmm. And she said it's not really a period of her life she likes to talk about that much and yeah. likes to revisit. But she has been on record as saying all this time that even though she admits that she and Margaret faked, quote unquote, 2% of mm-hmm. the phenomena, that the rest of it was genuine.
I absolutely believe her. Absolutely believe her.
And we kind of want to talk, I don't remember if we brought this up on the Mammoth Mountain show or not. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before, about poltergeist activity, about how sometimes they catch the kids faking something.
Priming the pump.
And that's what you call it. So kind of go into why you think that might be.
Priming the pump is... You know, I didn't invent this term. There were other people that have,
yeah.
have have noticed this. Sometimes the poltergeist agent or the poltergeist focus, which is the kid who is subconsciously manifesting this stuff, a new person will come into the environment who hasn't seen it yet. So then all of a sudden it's putting performance anxiety on the poltergeist focus because they're afraid that they're going to be ridiculed or afraid that that the poltergeist will be declared a fake and that they'll look like a fool. So you end up being under this performance anxiety, almost kind of like you're trying to, I like to say, like you're in a men's room trying to take a leak and there's a guy standing next to you in the urinal watching you.
Yeah,
you
that's can't a go. Good metaphor.
Yeah, that's like a good metaphor. So what they'll do is sometimes they'll fake something small to take the pressure off themselves and gain a little bit of confidence in the new visitor. And then once the pressure's off of the kid, then the real phenomena starts to flow.
Right.
And that's been observed.
Yeah.
And I would say none of that really happened in my case. I don't remember ever faking anything to get it going. It didn't have to. It just kept going.
Yeah.
And when somebody new would show up into the environment to see it, the phenomena would trail off. It would vanish for a while until the environment got more comfortable. I mean, when the scrutiny and the pressure wasn't there, and then all of a sudden it would start doing it again.
Yeah.
And then the new person could see it. So typically, when a new person comes to see a poltergeist event, the phenomenon is going to stop for a while.
Yeah.
Maybe an hour.
And Maury said that when he first got there, he didn't see anything for a while.
Yeah, it took a while.
And then it started.
Then it'll start. And it'll start small. And it'll start small.
Yeah.
And then it'll build up quickly.
Yeah. It should be noted, too, that, I mean, Janet and Margaret, and the two boys as well, they had just lost their father.
Yeah.
They were not in a good living situation. And, you know, all of a sudden, particularly Maurice Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, who both very nice guys.
Yeah.
Very fatherly, or maybe more avuncular than fatherly. But they were paying attention to the girls. They were at the house. They were taking care of them.
Yeah.
Bringing
food and candy and
buying
presents.
You know, maybe them wanting to keep this relationship up with the men, you know, kept the phenomena going.
Yeah, maybe.
And maybe if they were afraid that it was stopping or if it was afraid it was slowing down, they were afraid the men would leave.
Yeah.
So then they thought, well, maybe we'll fake something,
right,
you know, just so they don't leave us.
Yeah, the conditions in the house got better when Guy, Playfair, and Maurice Gross were there.
Yeah.
Because they treated everybody nice. They were nice guys.
Yeah. They were in and out of the house for, you know, a long period of time. So they, you know, they kind of got involved with the family and they, you know.
On a side note, the parapsychologist we work with, Steve Mara, knew Maurice Gross. They were in the SBR together for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It should be noted, too, that Maurice Gross, he lost his own daughter in a motorcycle accident.
Right. And a lot of people in the
her name was also Janet.
A lot of people in the SBR thought that maybe it wasn't good for Mr. Gross or Maurice Gross to be involved on that case because he had just lost his daughter, and they were kind of suggesting that maybe he was using this girl Janet as a surrogate daughter because his dead daughter's name was Janet.
Was Janet also? Even though his daughter was 18 when she died,
but
she died in a motorcycle accident.
But I think it's unfounded. And I also want to point out that the SBR was mostly skeptics.
Yeah.
They didn't even go to see this thing. They just heard the accounts and went, no, that's not happening. They didn't even go down there to go see.
Yeah.
Very few of them did. You know.
Yeah.
Those are armchair skeptics.
Yeah, true.
If you don't believe it, go down there and debunk it.
True. Yeah.
And James Randi went to this case too. And he was there just for a few minutes, about an hour, and then said, nothing's going on and left. He didn't want to give up.
Well, a lot of skeptics, magicians went there.
Yeah.
A few magicians, I think Milburn Christopher went there. He's a magician, and he thought the whole thing had been faked.
But you have to be there for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to get the girls comfortable, and then it'll start.
Yeah. So,
been through it.
You know, like I said, we don't know. So skeptics think it was all faked. I don't know about that. But anyway, it went on for a very long time, 18 months probably. And then, as a lot of these do, it kind of tapered off. Now, it should be noted that because there was so much media attention around this case, it actually didn't do much good for the kids. They all got bullied at school.
Yeah.
And picked on because they were in all the papers.
Right.
You know, the front page of one paper had a picture of Janet that said Devil Girl on it. You know, shit like, you know, the British press is. But so, so it wasn't a happy experience for them. And, I think, actually, are we at 40 minutes? I'm going to take a second break now, and then we'll come back and kind of say what happens subsequently, like after the...
Yeah, and we'll kind of wrap it up after that.
Okay. All right, so we'll be back in just a second.
There are terrors, real and imaginary, and I write about them all. Paranormal nonfiction. Horror fiction. The Rochdale Poltergeist. The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. The Associated Hopeful Monsters. Red Menace. The Five Tenebrous Poisons. Bellwether. Go to www.jennyashford.com. Or search Amazon for the Jenny Ashford author page.
Okay. So, I believe in a recent interview, Janet said she kind of credits, I think they did have a priest in to do a blessing or something like that. And evidently that it didn't make the phenomena stop, but it diminished, you know, to a point where it was no longer. Now, like I said, all the kids were kind of bullied at school because of the media attention and things like that. Now, when Janet was 16, she left home.
Okay.
And she got married, actually.
Yeah. I think they were all desperate to get out of that house.
They were all desperate to get out at this point. So she left. She got married, which obviously that didn't last because she was 16 years old. Now, she had a son, and her son died in his sleep when he was 18 years old.
Wow.
Another sad thing is that one of the younger brothers, Johnny, who was 10 when the phenomena started, he died of cancer when he was 14.
Weird.
So, not really. I don't really know what happened to Margaret or to the youngest kid, who Billy was the youngest kid. But they all kind of drifted. I think Billy ended up staying in the house until Peggy Hodgson died. She died of breast cancer in 2003. Now, Billy and Peggy both said that there was still some low-level paranormal activity at the house up until the mother died. Not anything super splashy. And this was after Janet and Margaret had left home. They said, you know, they still heard knocking on occasion, you know, and still stuff moving around a little bit, like to a lesser extent.
Yeah. I have an explanation for that, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, the phenomenon is non-local. If the poltergeist focus thinks about a certain place, it could cause the phenomenon to happen over there too. There's no maximum effective range.
Yeah.
So the focus doesn't need to be in the area.
Yeah.
It just doesn't.
Yeah.
Because if the focus can move an object without touching it 5 feet away, what difference does it make if that person's 50 miles away?
Yeah.
It's still supposedly impossible.
And we saw that in a similar case that I wrote about, the Rochdale poltergeist, which also took place in the UK, although it took place in the 90s, who the person that they thought was the focus, she did not actually have to be in the house. She could be across town and shit would still happen in the house.
Right.
Not to the same extent, like it would be lessened.
Right.
But she didn't have to be in the house for shit to happen.
Yeah, it's not conventional physics. Yeah. So whether or not the focus is actually in that house or not doesn't apply.
Yeah. Okay, so after Peggy Hodgson died in 2003, and Billy lived in the house for a while, and then he moved out. So all the family dispersed, and a new family moved in to the house. It's on Green Street in Enfield. I can't remember the number. I think it's 284, 264. But it's on Green Street in Enfield, North London. And they moved into the house. It was a council-owned house. It was a rental property. And they moved out. Now, apparently, they claim that they did not know that this was the famous Enfield poltergeist, because this was many years later.
I doubt that.
Yeah. They claim they didn't know when they moved in, but they said when they lived in the house, they heard strange noises. The son, a little kid, claimed he saw the apparition shadow figures, like in his room and things like that. Now, they only lived there for 2 months, and then they moved out. They said they didn't like it. They said they found out after they lived there for a while that, oh, this was the famous Enfield poltergeist house. Yeah, I don't know how you could not know.
Yeah, how could you not know? I think they were trying to make some bucks on a book or something like that.
Maybe.
Get a show.
But then another family moved in after, and that family, they did not want their identities. They just said, we don't want any press. We don't want any, we just want to live here and leave us alone.
They didn't notice anything.
No. Well, they won't talk to the media because they just didn't want the circus.
I guess. If they're still there, then that means they didn't notice anything.
Yeah, I don't know if they're still there or not. But it should be noted that the people that lived there after claimed that they also saw paranormal activity.
Okay.
But they said they didn't know it was the famous Enfield House. I don't know.
I don't buy that. How could you not know? All the neighbors knew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd think. I said, it had been a long time, but who knows? So just throwing that out there. Now, so I want to kind of put, because they've made so many, there are some documentaries from, I guess the documentaries were what, from the 80s?
From the 80s, yeah. One of the British one is really good.
Yeah, I do like that one. Yeah. It's all over YouTube. You can find it.
Right.
But, and they also, like I said, they also made a miniseries called The Enfield Haunting. That was last year, wasn't it? Last year or the year before?
That one was weaker, though.
It was okay. Like I said, the first two were, there's really good acting in it. I liked a lot of the actors in it. And the child actors were really good, too. But they really, really exaggerated.
Yeah, they exaggerated the relationship between Morris Gross and Playfair.
Yeah, they put conflict that wasn't there. Yeah,
that wasn't there. Those two got along real well.
Yeah, they made conflict between Maurice Gross and his wife, which didn't exist.
Right.
And they also really exaggerated the phenomena.
The phenomena itself.
I don't think Janet ever claimed to see Bill.
No, she never saw him.
But in the miniseries, you know, he's almost like an old man, like a ghost, like walking
around. Bill himself, in his own voice coming out of her throat, said, "I'm invisible."
Yeah, yeah, that's how he said it. Yeah, she never saw him. No. No one ever saw him.
No, actually, the neighbor said that he thought he saw a man, an apparition of man, when they were out of the house. Remember, the family left the house. But nobody knows. He was the only one that saw that.
Yeah, that could have just been
right.
A trick of the light or something like that.
Or he might have been his imagination running wild with him. Maybe he saw something like a mist, you know, like my blue haze. Maybe he saw something like that. Maybe it was a psychic impression in his head. Who knows? But if you really want to know the skinny, get the book.
Yeah.
Oh, man, this house is haunted. And it covers aspects of it that just you can't cover in the scope of a podcast or of a documentary. I mean, the depth is a lot better in the book.
It's good because it's just like, I mean, I can see how people might think it was like kind of quote unquote slow or whatever, because it's not like a Hollywood movie like Amityville or anything like that. It's just, it's very matter of fact. It's very day to day. This is what we saw today. This is what time it was. Mm. You know, this is the test we performed to make sure there was no faking, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So, you know, it's, I can see how people would think it was dry if they're used to, you know, super exaggerated.
Yeah, but it gives them an accurate picture of what a poltergeist phenomena is like to deal with.
Yeah, you know? Because a lot of it, and we talked about this a little bit on the Mammoth Mountain show too, a lot of it is just kind of random, meaningless shit.
Mindless repetition.
It doesn't have a plot.
Nope.
Per se.
Nope.
And I think that's kind of where a lot of movies...
No deeper meaning. It's just the whole thing's just an enigma.
Yeah.
How is it moving this? Why did it move that? Why did it do that? You know, that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah. Because a lot of it doesn't mean shit.
No.
A lot of it doesn't mean shit.
No, you don't want to read into what you're seeing, or you don't want to read into what's happening. You can go crazy.
True.
Yeah. You'll really scare yourself.
Okay, so is there anything we forgot to mention? I don't think there's anything we forgot to mention. That you wanted to kind of...
No.
Touch on?
No, I just wanted to plug that book because that's a classic. it's the benchmark case. I would say it's probably the best documented case in terms of the quality of the writing and the size of that case, the scope of that case. 18 months of it with all those witnesses.
And there were many, many, many witnesses.
Yeah.
Many witnesses.
Some of them cops, reporters.
Yeah.
So that's the case. That should be the first case anyone would read if they want to read about poltergeist case.
Yeah.
And what's cool, because it's not trapped into the ghost or ghost hunter mindset. It's, you know, they basically kind of gets into the realm of maybe science, new age, advanced physics. It's something along that lines, power of the mind. Even back in those days, they knew it was not, in this case, they knew that it wasn't some kind of a visitation from beyond. Wasn't really the dead. It was a ghost of the living.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. But draw your own conclusions just based on the eyewitness.
Yeah, there's all kind of different, you know, you can read the total skeptic perspective who just said, oh, the girls were faking the whole thing, or, you know, people were exaggerating or seeing things they didn't understand, whatever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can take the other tack, the people that were completely believers. Like I said, I'm kind of more inclined to believe people that were there, you know, with some of the stuff faked. Yeah, admittedly, some of it was faked.
Well, they weren't faking it. They were playing. Girls were playing around. They were playing around with Morris Gross.
Yeah. Because like I said, he almost became like an uncle figure or dad.
Yeah. And what they were playing around with was child's play compared to the actual poltergeist phenomenon, what people witnessed.
Yeah.
You know? You couldn't fake what was witnessed.
Yeah. Okay, so that'll probably do it for this episode. As I said, the audio-only podcast, we're now on the Project Entertainment Network. If that's where you get your download, it's not on iProject Radio anymore. And they also have a bunch of other podcasts that are really cool. So you can check those out as well. And as always, if you like our show, please find us on Facebook or Twitter or our YouTube channel, which are all under 13 O'Clock Podcast. Just search for that and you'll find us. And that'll probably do it for this episode.
Hold on one second.
What?
We got some cool new shirts.
That's right.
We got some really cool
shirts. I thought you were going to keep that quiet until we made a good commercial for it.
We got some really cool shirts. The thing is that we made them because we wanted them. But we'll give you guys a shot at them too, because they're really cool.
Yeah.
I like the Vril shirt.
Yeah. At the moment, there are 5 designs. It's 2 logo designs, with one with our famous logo with us on it, and the other one with the clock on it.
Yeah.
And we also have some that are based on some of our past shows. We have a Vril Society shirt that's very cool. That's Tom's favorite.
That's ready for the Goth Club.
Based on our Nazi occultism show.
Yeah.
We also have a really cool Satanic Panic one that looks very death metal.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And you couldn't see, but I made the horn hand then. And and also, we have one that was based on our serial poisoners, Jack the Ripper / show, that's kind of a poison, Victorian poison theme that's kind of cool. So if you want to look at the shirts, just go to zazzle.com/13o'clock.
Or follow the links.
Can I put a link? No, probably not. Not on the YouTube video.
No, you can't.
But I'll put one in the show notes on the YouTube video. Because you know how YouTube won't let you post links to it. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So, but if you go to Zazzle, you know, everybody knows Zazzle. They make t-shirts, blah, blah, blah. So we just have a show on there called 13 O'Clock. And go to all products and make sure your safe search is off, because that's why shit wasn't coming up on it. But I hope you enjoyed episode 12. And that's probably it, right?
Yeah, kind of sleepy.
Kind of sleepy.
Yeah,
you just got up.
I don't know, man. I'm lazy.
Yeah,
I'm lazy.
You are. Aw.
Hey, let's go. We'll wrap it up.
All right.
All right.
All right. Bye, you guys.
Bye.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.